You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hey, welcome to Long Form Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hey, good to see you guys.
Really nice to see you, gentlemen.
Hey, who did we have this week, Evan?
This week we have Max interviewing Joel Lovell, who is an editor at the New York Times Magazine. He's also a writer. Recently, you would have seen a cover story that he wrote about George Saunders in the Times Magazine, which he talks a lot about. And he was also at GQ. He was a writer for GQ. And he's one of the most respected long-form editors in the business.
A minor disclaimer, Max and I went to Pittsburgh to do an event at which this was taped. Thanks to Pitt Writers, who are an academic supporter of long-form. And the sound did not come out perfect. In fact, I would say it came out far from perfect. We considered nixing this episode, but we heard from several people had heard it that it was their favorite episode so far. Joel was a really incredible interview. So we've decided to air it, take it with a grain of salt, and maybe try listening to it with headphones. All right, enough of that. We do have a sponsor. That sponsor is Tiny Letter from the good people at MailChimp. It's the simple way to send an email newsletter. We thank them for their support. Here's Max and Joel.
Live from Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much for having us, University of Pittsburgh. And thank you very much, Joel Lovell, for coming all this way.
That's okay, I'm very happy to be here.
I have to ask you about like many, many things. I have a whole slew of topics, none of which I prepared you for. But we should start, I think, with the profile of George Saunders. As I read it, I got the sense that you knew the guy pretty well. How long had you known him before you started reporting the story?
It's funny, I mean, I knew him a little bit, but not very well before the story. I mean, I knew his work very, very well. I had read his work really closely for a long time. And we had sort of overlapping worlds a little bit. He wrote, three or four stories for GQ. But I wasn't his editor there. He wrote a tiny thing for me at the Times Magazine when I first went over there a couple of years ago. We did this education issue, and we asked a bunch of people to write about their best, the sort of most formative education experience of their life. And he wrote this very nice and sweet piece about these two high school teachers that he had. So, you know, we had a couple experiences, but I didn't know him well at all.
Was it a piece that you've been wanting to write for a long time? Was his new book an excuse to do it, or?
Yeah, no, I hadn't thought about writing about him, but I mean, I wanted to know him, really, is what I wanted to do. I mean, it sounds a little stalkerish, but it's true.
It comes through in the piece.
I know, a little too much, I think. But he, I got a galley of his book back in September, and I'd read, probably half the stories that are in that book, roughly half of them in New York, and I read those ones, and he made a wonderful mix of meanings. And I read that book, and I was so blown away by how great it was. And it really felt to me, in three or four stories in that book, I really felt like he was just doing something that nobody else had ever done, as far as I could tell, in fiction. And certainly breaking new ground for himself. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if the New York Times Magazine could do a big cover story on a short story writer, and just say, like, here's this incredibly great writer who has this real passionate but fairly small following, and just sort of announced to the world, that this is just somebody you should be reading. And I didn't think that my boss would go for it, but I sent him this long, impassioned email. I just, this is why we should do this. This guy, he's not just a great writer, but he's an incredible person. And for some reason, he went for it. I don't know exactly why. And then he read the story, and he said, sure, let's do it.
So he didn't even know Saunders, though?
You know, he knew him, but hadn't really read his work that much. But it's not like a natural... It's not a natural magazine decision to say, you know what, let's put a middle-aged white short story writer on the cover of the magazine. Right. I mean, the white and the male part of it, obviously, they get plenty of coverage on the cover of the magazine.
Only young men in the New York Times magazine.
But doing a big story on a short story writer is not necessarily an obvious thing. And I was just sort of happy to do a story where, I mean, I should probably sound more sophisticated than this, but I sort of knew going into it was just going to be a love letter to him.
Well, I mean, that was one of the things I was wondering about. Like, were there any plans ever to do it straight? I mean, like, did you ever think about masking your love?
I did. I mean, I thought a lot of times that it was maybe overly, overly enthusiastic, you know, and then a little overly personal. But then I thought, you know, what the hell? It's either gonna feel honest or it's gonna completely embarrass me. But I'd rather be embarrassed trying to do something honest than just do kind of like. Sort of standard by the book magazine.
Did that like crystallize as you were reporting it, or did you go up to like upstate New York the first time and was like, here comes the love?
No, it definitely happened in the report. I mean, we became, you know, it's this thing that I think probably occasionally happens to people who do these kinds of stories is you spend, I mean, he was really, really open at this time for once. We spent a lot of time together, even more than sort of suggested in the story. And each time we met, it just felt like this friendship was deepening. And then I thought, well, to I don't know, it seemed like I wanted to sort of honor that in some way. And that sounds corny.
No, I mean, I do know what you mean. It also felt to me like that experience you're talking about with that you had reading the book, the emotions that it brought up in you, these kind of authentic emotions for like vulnerability and openness. Those are themes in the story, but it also felt to me like the story was designed in a way to evoke those same things. It's the same. I wondered whether you think nonfiction has that capability, whether journalism can do that thing that fiction can do.
Yeah, the short answer is I do. I think it's very hard to do, and I think when honestly, there were plenty of whiffs of drafts with this, and drafts that were really, really bad, and people read and sort of saved me from.
They were like, roll it back.
I didn't realize it. I mean, honestly, I'll get to a more straight answer of your question in a second.
But, straight answer to that.
But the first draft of this story had, there was a 1,000-word opening, a little over 1,000 words, which I was just convinced was the best magazine story opening that anybody had ever heard.
Wow. People are going to be blown away by this.
And it was very emotional. That sounds creepy. I know you're going to be like, wow, he's going to say that. But the story was this. I was at the playground with my daughter, who's 5, my youngest daughter, and I was talking to somebody, and she was up on this, one of those fireman poles. So her head was probably 9 feet off the ground, and she lost her handle on the pole, and she fell backwards, and she fell straight back, and I watched her come down, and she hit the ground, and, you know, her head hit first. And I sort of scrambled, I had to jump over something to get to her, and I got to her, and she was totally unconscious. I mean, she was out. And it was really terrifying. She was out for a while. And I was screaming her name over and over, and there was a woman, a mother next to me, and she was saying, wow, should I call an ambulance? Should I call an ambulance? And it was like a solid 30 seconds where she was out, but it felt like she was out for a month. I mean, I couldn't, you know, she just wasn't moving. And I was really, really scared. And then she came to, we got her to the emergency room. They did a scan. She was, you know, she had a concussion. They sort of looked for bleeding. She was fine. I got her home, and I was, you know, I was kind of quaking all night. And my wife was out of town at work. So I got all my kids into bed and I put them to sleep. And then that night was the first time I read this story called Semplica Girl Diaries, which is the story in the collection. Essentially about a father who is sort of struggling to provide for his family. I mean, it's about a lot of things, but that's like the domestic part of the story is that. And I felt so powerfully moved by that story. I mean, I literally felt like the story is speaking to me right now in this way that only the most sort of powerful art can do. And I was very well, overwhelmed with emotion. And so, to make a long story even longer, I wrote, I wrote this opening that was all, it was all about that scene and my looking at my kid and then reading the story at night, going back to check on her to make sure she was okay, crying. And I thought, wow, this is going to be a powerful opening. And I gave it to people and they were like, wow, you see, this just seems crazy. I was just so impressed. How have you done that? Well, I mean, I think maybe in another setting it probably could have been, it's a story that could be written and mean something, maybe, if it's done right. I certainly don't know if I was doing it right or not. But I think as an opening to a story in that magazine, it probably would seem a little crazy to the truth. So I've gone. What actually ended up in the magazine was much less personal, in fact, than
where I was. I'm just not asking you, like, stop your relationship questions a second. But I feel like there's got to be some difficulties or challenges, or at least I would be terrified of writing a profile of a great writer, writing about a great writer. And, like, part of the dynamic of this podcast is often that, like, I'm interviewing people who are master interviewers, and I'm doing it quite poorly. Was that scary? Like, was that in your head, like, oh, man, not only is, like, this guy going to be, affected by everything I write, and anytime you write about anybody, they're going to look for the little details in his mouth, but also he's going to be like, I wouldn't have gotten there with the kicker. Was that dynamic there?
In my head, it was very, very much there. I mean, he was, like I said, he was a very generous guy. So generous in all these conversations and really generous with his answers and open and honest. And so, there was a lot of material to work with. So I felt like I had a little bit of a backstop in that if I did nothing else in the piece other than just write transitional sentences between his long quotes, it would be all right. But then late in the game, I don't know how much this is interesting to anybody, but I got pretty blocked up. I had a very hard time writing it. And 4 days before the magazine was supposed to be sent to the printer, I basically had scrapped 12,000 words. I had nothing.
Because you felt like it wasn't just capturing it?
I felt like I wasn't getting him right. I felt like I couldn't get the balance right between the personal stuff and then trying to explain what his stories were about and trying to explain his background. There was just, there was too much information to choose from, and I couldn't figure out which stuff to include in the science package that I had. And so it just felt like I could never get the counterbalances right. And I really then, like, as we got closer and closer to the deadline, I felt like the story was a failure. I sent him a couple emails and I said, look, I just want to let you know that I know you gave me all this time. I know this is, a cover story in the Times Magazine is important for a writer because it could affect book sales. But like this, this is, prepare yourself because this is going to be a letdown.
How many of those emails did you write?
I wrote one about 3 days before it closed, and I wrote one to him the day that the story was going to go up online. That morning I woke up, and I really woke up with some dread, and I sent him an email. I said, just so you know, it's coming out today, I couldn't quite pull off what I wanted to, and thanks for all of your time, and I'm sorry.
Have you ever sent, like, a caveat email like that before?
No. It was crazy. And he wrote back this very nice email. He said, look, first of all, I write short stories, and, my name's going to be on the cover of the New York Times Magazine, so already it's a win situation.
Good deal.
And he said, I appreciate these conversations, it was good, so, all any writer or anybody can ask for the subject of a piece of writing is that somebody try to be honest and thoughtful, and if you've done that, then we'll be fine. And that was very comforting.
And then, once you read it, what was his reaction?
Oh, it was nice. He sent a nice message.
Did it take, like, the entire internet telling you that story was great? How many emails that were like, that story was amazing? What did it take for you to be like, okay, maybe it wasn't a total bust?
It was, by the end of day one, I felt pretty good about it. And still, I think this is the thing that happens with any writers, just to get it off me for a second, because there's always, like, the platonic form of the thing you're writing that you have in your mind, and then there's this, especially magazine writing, because there are all these other contingencies that come into play, right? There's space, and there's time, and there's, just all these things that don't have to do with whatever arty thing you have in your head. We got to get this out the door. And so there's, I think even the best writers end up feeling like what goes out is often a little bit monstrous compared to the thing that's in their mind. And so I was very intensely feeling that. And even so, I still, even after the nice response to the piece and George's book has done well, and so I feel like that in some ways reflects on what the story was, I still scratch my head a little bit and think like, I wish that my internal experience matched the external reaction a little bit better. But it's kind of, I'm coming around.
Well,
it sounds so crazy, I'm sorry. It sounds very like...
Dude, that's not even close to the craziest sounding thing you said to me. Your experience with it is interesting to me, in part because it felt, you're all over that story.
Yeah.
You tend to put yourself into your work quite a bit. Is that something that you encourage other writers to do? Is that something that turns you off in other writings? Could you have imagined a way to write that piece for the other stuff you do without yourself into it?
I can imagine the piece, a great piece that never had the first person pronoun in it, I just don't know that I could have written that piece. And not because I have so many wonderful things to say, like that I'm so incredibly interesting, but from I just sort of know where my limits are, and one of the limits I came up against over and over again with that story is just that I didn't trust my own lit crit abilities a little bit. I felt like I couldn't fall back on that kind of authority, that sort of analytical authority.
There wasn't a way to talk about his work without being clear about how his work has affected you.
Yeah, and then I just thought, well, look, the reason you want to do this is because you find this fiction more than almost any, certainly more than any contemporary fiction that I can think of. I just find it personally moving in a way that just is important to me, And so I thought, well, if that's what you feel, then try to get that across. Yeah.
You started as a fiction writer,
yeah,
and then moved into magazines. Did you have aspirations of being a writer for magazines, or did you want to be an editor from the start? How did that work?
It really was a sort of, it wasn't a very intentional process. I went to the MFA program, the fiction writing program at the University of Michigan, and I had a great couple of years there, and I stuck around. I was teaching fiction the year after I graduated and trying to write some short stories. And then I really sort of lucked into this job. I started working as a stringer for Harper's Magazine, because back, this is in the pre-internet days. And so, Harper's had what they still have, this reading section. The way that the reading section works is they've got people at Harper's who are constantly scouring for things to put in that section, and then they hire a handful of stringers who are just also out there in the world looking for things and reading newspapers and reading literary journals and whatever. So I was one of those people. And it was really fun. I loved it. And then a job opened up at Harper's and they offered it to me. And at the time I didn't think I wanted to be a magazine editor. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was thinking, well, maybe I could get a job teaching at college, or, maybe my wife will be really successful and I'll just be able to cook dinner when she comes home.
My pleasure. Absolutely my
But then this job at Harper's came along, and I thought, well, I'd love reading Harper's. Sure, why not try it? I had to take an editing test and all that sort of stuff. They didn't just say, like, hey, come on over here and work for us. I had to do a little bit of work for it. But I was so less qualified then, and this is not false modesty at all. It's very, very true. I was so less qualified then to have that job than any editorial assistant at any magazine in New York right now. Absolutely. Every time I've ever hired somebody or interviewed somebody, I read their resumes and I talk to them, and I can't believe how talented they are compared. I mean, in talented, they're accomplished and they've done things and they've thought about things.
You must have thought about things.
Sure, I thought about certain things, but I didn't really have a magazine mind. And if you talk to anybody who's trying to get an editorial assistant job now in New York City, or I'm sure at least outside of New York, they really know magazines. They know them backward and forward. They think about them, and they think about how magazines exist online. And they're very sophisticated about it in a way, that I was just like, oh, sure, I like stories. This is great, I mean, and I'm very, very happy and lucky that I got that job. But I don't think I was terribly qualified for it, honestly.
So what was it like when you showed up?
It was intimidating. I struggled for a while. It was a little bit like...
What does struggling as a magazine editor look like?
Well, it's a sort of psychic struggling because you just feel that everybody around, you know, that you're the dumbest guy in the room a little bit.
I know that feeling.
And there, you know, there are a lot of pretty smart people there, and there are a lot of people who, there are a lot of people who are comfortable, or at least at the time, were comfortable demonstrating their smartness.
Such a delightful. Believe the more commonly used phrase is asshole. So anyway, you were going with a bunch of assholes. When did your confidence pick up? I mean, like, what was it one story that just killed it? You know, you started feeling like, okay, well, maybe this magazine stuff is for me? Was it a slow thing and you woke up 15 years later and you're like, I'm a magazine editor and I've been doing this forever?
No, it took a while. There was a guy in there who was sort of my mentor, although he's younger than I am. This guy named Paul Tuff, who's he's now a reporter and writer. He just wrote this wonderful
amazing book,
How Children Succeed, which is an amazing piece of journalism and writing. But he was the guy who was running the reading section of Harper's as well as editing stuff that's in the magazine. And he just seemed to me like the coolest and smartest and most interesting person I'd ever met. And he still is. And I just thought I wanted to learn how to do what that guy does. And I basically just watched him for a long time trying to figure out how to do this.
Did you have aspirations still of writing fiction? Do you still have aspirations of writing fiction? I mean,
Yeah.
Do you?
Not much. Just recently I have been. It's funny. Reporting and thinking about the Saunders story just made me feel like I was living in a world of fiction again in a way that I haven't in a long, long time. And it was really nice. It felt great to be doing that. It was exciting.
How does fiction inform your journalism? How does it help you think about magazine stories?
Well, I think if you're a fiction writer, or if you've read a lot of fiction, or if you've studied fiction, you've internalized an idea about storytelling, right? Just like you just sort of know what makes an interesting story, and so and those instincts are really, really useful, I think, when you do magazine journalism, because there are a lot of people who are great reporters and can get information that other people can't get, and then there are other people who are great stylists, but who aren't necessarily terrific at figuring out how to get people to tell them stuff or to find things out. And then you realize, like, oh, well, if you can exist somehow a little bit in both of those worlds, if you can learn a little bit about how to report, and then you have this instinct for storytelling, you can be really, really useful at a magazine, either as an editor or as a writer, because it's a pretty thin band of people, I think, who can do both of those things. Going back to your earlier question, I think the thing that started making me feel confident at Harper's at some point was this feeling that no matter what I was editing, whether it was like a tiny little 300-word thing in the reading section or a short story, I ended up editing a bit of fiction there, a short story, or when I started doing more journalistic stuff there, I just started realizing, like, oh, right, I know how to keep this story interesting. I know where it sags. And you know, if you've been in a workshop, this is why I think workshops are, among other reasons, very, very useful. Is you start to develop that sense of where the heat in the story lies and where the heat of the story dies out. You know, you start thinking, like, okay, well, it dies out here. What do we need to do to turn it off? So, you know, and it just becomes instinctual to you. I think that's.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked for several newspapers, and I feel like part of that moment for me where I would get more confident in the place was also when I knew that it was a story that fit the paper. Like I knew what a city paper story was,
yeah.
And then I wrote a city paper story, and then it was like that city paper story is in the city paper, and like, okay, this really, we're starting to figure this out.
Exactly, yeah.
How does that work when you go from a place like Harper's to a place like GQ, to a place like New York Times Magazine? What are the connections between those kinds of stories? And I guess part of what, so you went from Harper's and you eventually ended up at GQ, or where did you go next?
I went from Harper's, and then I went to the Times Magazine
right.
for a while then, and I was a story editor there. In between, I briefly went to Canada and worked for a magazine called Saturday Night.
You worked for Saturday Night?
I did, yeah.
This did not come up in my internet.
Yeah, I think so.
Verve scrum. Were you there when Verve Carl's Lead was published?
I was indeed there.
Tell me your business story.
I did.
Eight minutes.
That's a great, great story. I think it's one of the best part stories I've ever read.
It absolutely is one of the best part stories.
You are one of seven people who read it.
Good. I'd love to just let us put it up on Mockwell. Put it up.
Is that right?
Yeah, we're covered off some PDF.
God, that's awesome.
Yeah,
it's a great story.
We should probably not.
So I went briefly to Saturday Night because this guy I was talking about, Paul Tuff, he left Harper's and became the editor-in-chief of Saturday Night. So I went up there, worked with him for a while, and then the magazine sort of fell apart and I came back to New York.
Because you never live up to Merck Girl's Lead.
Right, exactly. And then I worked at the Times Magazine for a while, for 4 years, and then went to GQ for 5 years. I guess
what's interesting is you move around these places. I feel like there must be a balance between how much you're being expected to bring your style and your perspective to the magazine, and how much you're being expected to bend to the magazine, what the magazine does,
right,
what the magazine thinks of itself.
With the subject matter, at least in my case, was never very different. There was never a story that I was working on at GQ that I couldn't imagine being a New Yorker story or being a Times story or whatever. My feeling about the Times, having been at GQ for a while, was, you know, here's this, like, they obviously do great work, important journalism, but it felt to me like the magazine had become a little stiff, you know? And one of the things I really want to do is just create a sort of broader spectrum there and create a place for more literary writing and a little bit more voice-driven writing. And so, you know, one of the immediate ways of doing that was having a couple of writers who I worked with at GQ come meet me there. This guy, a guy named John Jeremiah Sullivan, who's has a very recognizable voice when he writes.
I know that guy.
You want to find young writers who are two things. Extremely, extremely hungry to do stories, right? Just burning to do magazine stories.
How can young writers send that signal up to you? What do you look for? What is that tenaciousness?
I mean, if somebody sends you a pitch, like you can tell within the first paragraph of reading a pitch. I don't mean necessarily that they should be like all hopped up. You can just tell, like, okay, there is an intelligence, an energy, an enthusiasm, and an awareness of the world and of the magazine that this writer wants to write for going on here. You can tell it almost immediately, you know? And you think, this is a person who has a sophisticated sense of what this magazine does and wants to do that thing. So that's one thing. And then the other is magazine writing is hard and it's tiring and you know, you can sort of, I think if you do it for a long time, you can fall into a little bit of a rhythm where you first think, like, you know, there's a kind of sausage making to it. You think, like, I got a good magazine story. You do this kind of lead, you do this kind of thing, you do this kind of, and you're out. And what I really, really want are people who don't think that way yet about magazine stories. Instead, they think, this is just an opportunity to tell a great story, and I'm a really good storyteller, and I want to flex it. You know,
is part of that because those people are more open to editing? That relationship can be more open.
I think so. Yeah, yeah. They just they want to learn how to do it. Yeah.
When did you start editing Sullivan?
2005.
So kind of, I mean, sort of early-ish in his career.
Yeah, he had written one truly, truly great story for Harper's about horse racing, which he won a National Magazine Award for and became his first book, his book, Blood Horses. And then he started writing at GQ, and he and I started working together. And his next big story was this story about a Christian rock festival. And really the moment, I mean, I knew John, I knew him a little bit before that, and I knew he was a very smart guy, and I loved this piece in Harper's, but I sort of thought, like, maybe that was like the one great piece he has in him. It was also about his dad, it was stuff that he knew very well. You know, and then he did this Christian rock story, and I read it, and just thought, wow, this is a real special writer. Like, this is a writer who people are going to read for a long time.
When you get that first draft, I mean, how close to the final version was that first take? What's your job then?
Well, with that story, with him in general, I think he would agree with this if he was here. There was just way too much, you know. He had a hard time sort of seeing how to put the story together. So it was a lot of incredible material, but it wasn't organized especially well. You know, he turned in a 24,000 word draft, I think. And
The equivalent would ask us what your job was.
So yeah, the first part of the job is just saying like, okay, well let's get this down to half its length,
right,
and then talk about editing. Yeah.
Sullivan came basically with you from GQ to the New York Times. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That feels to me like you guys have a relatively strong relationship. You should know that I've talked to some people who know you before you and I talked, and they all basically said the same thing, which is like nobody loves anyone, any editor, like they love Joel.
Well, that's nice to hear.
Yeah, there's no way for you to slough that one out. That's like, a legitimate compliment. I'm trying to embarrass you, but
thanks, people. Good night.
Yeah. Why? You know what do you do that other people don't? Why is John Jeremiah selling this huge magazine writer? Why is he willing to jump ship? What's the secret?
Well, I mean, you know, I think with John specifically, we just worked on a lot of big stories together. We've developed a kind of language that we both understood, and I think he just trusted that, and he felt like I understood his writing, and then you know, there's a little bit of a psychological component. In some ways, being an editor it's as much just talking to people as it is doing stuff on a page, and I think with him and with other people. The thing I like, I don't know if I'm especially great at it, but the thing I like the most about the job is just being on the phone and having them talk about the story and say, I don't know what's interesting, I can't tell. And then you just keep talking about it. And between the two of you, you start to see something nice take shape, you know? And I think if you can make a writer feel, this is going to sound incredibly corny, but if you can make a writer feel like it's okay to not know what they're doing, right? They don't really know exactly what their story is. They're a little lost in their material. Like, that's a fine place to be, and you can sort of talk it through. And you can minimize their anxiety a little bit, then I think you've done most of your job. Then after that, it's just looking at the words and figuring out which ones work.
So it's like a combination of editing and therapy.
A little bit. I mean, therapy might be a little strong. I mean, in some cases not. In some cases,
wow.
It feels...
I mean, I've been struck. I mean, one of the things that's been nice about this podcast, we've had all these amazing writers on, and they've all basically said the same thing with a few exceptions. Most people have said, I'm incredibly nervous before every story.
Yeah.
As soon as I finish one, I don't think I'm ever going to find one that good again.
Right.
Even at this kind of upper echelon of this stuff, it is the type of work where you go from, you know, 0 to 60 and right back to 0.
Yeah.
How long does that process take when you're working on a piece? How long do you give Sullivan on a story?
I mean, it's as you'd imagine, especially the place, the Times, where it's coming out every week, and a lot of the stories are news driven, right? So they have, if they don't have hard pegs, there's also like a moment within which you want to publish them. So different kinds of stories have different paces, and sometimes it's very, very fast turnaround. You think like, oh, there's this thing that just happened. I don't know. There's Gaddafi's been overthrown. We want to get somebody there right now, and we want that story in the magazine in 2 weeks. So that's an incredibly small window within which to do that kind of story. Other times, and this tends to be the case with stories that John works on, which aren't so news driven, you just say, okay, we're gonna send this great writer whose mind we really trust into this situation, and we're gonna let him absorb it as much as he can, and then come back and try to write it. And so it's not driven so much by the magazine's dictates as it is by that writer's pace and process. And then it becomes, your job as an editor becomes, you become a little bit of a scold or a nag or you try to get stuff out of them faster than they might otherwise want to do it.
Do you have to like that part of the job to do the job, or is that like a part that nobody likes? Because that sounds horrible.
Yeah, nobody likes nagging. I think over time you develop all sorts of tricks. You learn the psyche of all of your writers. It sounds so much more Machiavellian. but you know, like, well, if I say this kind of thing, then he'll rise to that occasion.
You've written a lot about money.
Yeah.
And you have written about money in a way that I, at least personally, find really helpful. I just turned 31. I just got married. I am a partner in a small business. All of a sudden, I'm realizing, A, I should probably start thinking about money, and B, I don't understand shit.
Yeah.
All of your stuff kind of is like from that exact point of view. And not you know shit, but it, you write about money in this kind of emotional way rather than a pragmatic way, which I find really helpful. You had a column in GQ for a long time mm-hmm. called Men and Money. And I guess I wonder how much your upbringing had to do with the way that you write about money. I should say that in my family, like talking about money is used kind of like some like very rare weapon that you can only use very occasionally, but it kills people immediately. Like we never talk about it, but then when it comes up, it like clears the room. You know, so I'm pretty bad at talking about it.
Well, was your family about it? No, my family's terrible about it. As I think most families are one way or another. The way I started writing about money was that we were sitting around in an editorial meeting in GQ, and we were trying to think of different kinds of columns to put into the magazine. And my boss said, "Gosh, we should have a money column, but I don't want it to really be an investment advice column because everybody does that, and it just seems dull." And again, Andy Ward, who was Jean Marie's editor, and who knew a little bit about my background and you know my neuroses, really, helpfully piped up in the meeting, "Oh, Joel should do that because he's a mess with money. He's crazy. He's a total disaster."
Did anyone ever write you and be like, "That was terrible financial advice. You cost me thousands."
Well, no, I mean, I really specifically wasn't giving investment advice except for this one time where I wrote about, this is going to get really exciting now. If you have coffee, drink it now. I wrote about 401ks. I literally had no idea how one set up a 401k and even what they were. And I just didn't understand. And then how did you divide your investments in them? And so I set out to learn like just basic stuff. Okay, I need to have a retirement account. How do I do it? And then within that, I talked to enough of investment people. And I started thinking, like, "Oh, I understand this now." And I got a little cocky, and I started giving some advice. And I started giving that advice. I believe it was in late August or early September of 2008.
August just was like very such a healthy time.
And I was just like, "This is what you should do. You should be investing in these kinds of things, index funds." Here's what I'm like, "I don't know about index." A month before, I had no idea what index fund was, and I was talking about it like I was. Jim Cramer, and that column came out literally the month that the bottom dropped out of the global economy, and I ended up writing this thing for the Washington Post about that experience. And it wasn't like I was picking specific stocks, but what I realized in doing that and in talking to all these guys is that nobody really, really knows, right? I mean, there's no expert who actually knows what he's talking about. I mean, I was wrong, but everybody down the line was wrong. I mean, even guys who are getting paid a lot of money to go on TV and say, "This is how you should invest your money," they were wrong. They had no idea what they were talking about. And that idea struck me as very interesting, that like it's a very American idea, right? Just to be sure of things, right? We're not a culture that's comfortable with not being sure of things, with not knowing. And that got us into some real trouble. I mean, lots of other people operating in bad ways got us into trouble too, but it's also this cultural, like a cultural psyche issue, which is like, we like to pretend like we know what we're doing, and oftentimes we don't, and it's okay and probably better to say, "I don't actually know." That to me seems like a very useful place to exist as a writer and as an editor. It's just this idea that like every time you go, you embark on a new story, or you open a new door, I think the most useful thing, the most useful place to operate from is a place of not knowing.
Money kind of goes through that Saunders story too.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason I was so drawn to him. Is he? I mean, I didn't know the specifics of his background, but you read his stuff, and I thought, "Wow, this is a guy who knows exactly who I am and where that anxiety lives." You know, and he's just so compassionate towards people who aren't on the winning side of the ledger. You know?
Yeah, I mean the theme in that story around money, which is also something that you've written about a lot, is this kind of idea that like it's not about going for more money necessarily, but it's about what that not having money, you lose grace.
Yes.
Or not having it, like not having money brings disgrace. Not that having money particularly brings it,
right.
But there's a guarantee that if you don't, it's very hard to be graceful.
Exactly. And I felt like, without getting too sort of pornish about it, I felt like that was very much my experience growing up, not just in my own family, but we grew up in a part of upstate New York where there just aren't a lot of people around who have a lot of money. And over time, as you grow up and you become a little bit more attentive to it and aware of it, you see that in action all the time. It's exactly that. It's just the slow grinding away of grace. That's George's word for it, which I think is the perfect word. And you see the way, like, it's hard to be generous when you're so stressed and so tired, you know? It's hard to be the parent you want to be, or the partner you want to be, or the, you know, it's hard to do when you're carrying around that kind of anxiety. And I think there's not a great cultural appreciation for that existential state.
You edit a lot of people who are in some form of that existential state. I mean, magazine writing, even at the top level, is not a particularly lucrative pursuit.
Yeah.
I guess I have a couple of questions. Well, one is, I mean, I think money in magazines in New York is a weird thing. You don't make very much. The cost of entry is really high. There's a reason, I think, there's a reason that the people who staff most of the magazines are grew up on the East Coast and went out of the schools, because there's a cost of entry into that business. You have to put in unpaid time.
Yep.
Or you have to put in time well below the line. And be able to, but the other thing is you have to kind of like weirdly keep up appearances. How do you manage that existential like crisis in your writers or in people in this world who are trying to break into it? Is there advice that you have for people who maybe do not have the advantages that most people who make it in magazines have?
I do. I mean, I don't know if I have actionable advice, but I have lots of sympathy. And in part because, I mean, that was very much my experience. I mean, my experience when I went to college was one of just feeling like I was the hillbilly among sophisticates. And then my experience going to New York, where I'd literally never been in my life. It took me a long time to get over this feeling of being a bit of an imposter in that world. I guess I can say that word right now, but it took a while. And even writing that column for GQ, there was some part of me, some self-satisfying part of me too, that felt like I was a little bit like, I was just sticking it to that world a little bit, because, you know, you work at Condé Nast and it's a building full of luxury magazines, you know, with
it's a luxury building.
It's a luxury magazine. And luxurious people, and, you know, and those magazines kind of relentlessly telling people that they need to buy things that won't make them any happier, you know, that are very expensive. And I felt like, oh, if I can kind of get this slightly subversive message into this magazine, that will make me feel better about myself. And it did a little bit. It is a simultaneous sort of feeling of shame, and also, you know, it's converted to superiority a little bit and anger. But it was hard to, it's hard to move in that world and feel like, wow, I just don't have enough, you know? And it's not like there are specific things that I wanted. You just felt like, my apartment's crappy, and my furniture is a futon, and I'm 40 years old, and my three kids live like in a basement room. I mean, it's a perfectly fine apartment. It's a very, very nice neighborhood in Brooklyn, but it's less nice than everybody else's apartment I know. And I don't mean for me in any way. We are wildly, wildly rich compared to 99.9% of the world, and yet within that little circumscribed world, you're just constantly aware of your own less thanness. And so, to now answer your question, I understand that state of being a writer and wanting so badly to write, and then also just being so anxious about finances, and the way that those two things can be at cross purposes. And so, you know, one of the things you can do is try to say to writers, like, look, what I can help you do is put a great magazine story into this magazine, and when you do that, this many people are going to read it, and it's going to give you a boost, both in terms of your esteem, but also it's going to lead to more work, and that's how we'll put it together.
Joel, man, I really appreciate you coming all the way down to Pittsburgh.
I really appreciate being here. Thanks very much.
Especially with all of your incredible travel. The people who stuck around, you guys have questions for Joel? Let me go to that microphone.
So I have a question about what you said about writers and editors like living in the space of not knowing, mm-hmm. and that being this really productive space. And so I feel like when you pitch, the idea is that you should know, or you should really seem like you know, right, to convince someone like you that this is a story that I really want to publish, and this writer really knows a ton about it. So how do you balance that tension, I guess, of being working on a story and maybe not knowing, or having all this material and working your way through it, and writing a pitch where you seem really confident that you do know and that you can map this whole thing out in its stages and whatnot?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think the balance you want to strike is that you know enough that whatever you're going to discover. Whatever you're going to discover, you're going to be prepared. You're equipped for that discovery, right? So what you don't want, and I think this goes for any kind of writing. If Billy came up and was talking about fiction writing, he'd say that if you go into a story already knowing, not both literally what the end is in terms of plot, but also like what the theme, like what you want to say, then you're probably you're already crippling that story. Because something has to happen. Like there's got to be a discovery that happens. In the process, and I think the same thing goes for great nonfiction writing too. So what you want to convey is this sense of like, here's this thing that I'm very, very interested in. I'm not just interested in it because I read a little bit about it and I thought like, oh, that's cool. Maybe I could write that. I'm interested in it because either I have this life experience that somehow informs that interest and gives me a kind of expertise, or I'm interested in it just because it is a topic that absolutely obsesses me, and because it obsesses me, I've learned this and this and this, and I imagine a story that will lead to this kind of, not conclusion exactly, like you don't want to have the answers up front, like I was saying, but like, this, you know, I can imagine a story that will have this kind of effect, right? And I know enough going in that I know I'll be able to look for the things that are going to give me that effect. Does that make any, I mean, it's a very abstract answer, does that make any sense?
Okay. Yeah, that makes total sense.
The one thing I'll say about pitching, if you guys don't mind, is you basically want to do the editor's job for them. And any editor who's receiving your pitch is in a position where they have to go to their boss and they have to say, here's the story I think we should assign. And their boss is going to say why, and so you want to give them all the information they need to say, this is why this is a good story. So it can't be that you go to them and say, I'm kind of interested in it, will you give me a chance? You've got to say to them, like, you've got to imagine them as like, I've got to give this person the material they need to go to this other person and have them say yes. You know, it's up to you to arm them. So that's mostly what I mean by like demonstrating that you know enough.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I have one more question. I did ask a couple people who know you about what I should ask you before you did this, and I'm just going to read a question provision from a colleague of yours.
All right.
Why is he so goddamn smart and kind and good-looking? Why doesn't he age like a normal person? How can the rest of us be more like him? Has he ever had an enemy? And if so, who is it? Can we go beat that person up on his behalf? Very nice. Is there anyone? Can we go take someone's ass?
I'll think of somebody.
Thanks, Joel.
Sure. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I know I say that every week, and I mean it every week. This week, a special thank you, extra amount of thanks. I know the sound was not great, and we just thought the interview was worth it. And if you got to this point, I guess you thought that too, so I'm not going to apologize too much. But thank you. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Evan Ratliff and Aaron Lammer. Our editor is Lauren Kirchner, and our intern is Sarah Mondalare. Thanks very much to the University of Pittsburgh for hosting us and continuing to support what we do over here at Longform. Go check them out, Pitt Writers. And thanks very much to Joel Lovell. Joel was in Pittsburgh for like 10 hours. The guy had a flight canceled. That interview started like 30 seconds after he walked into the room, and he couldn't have been more gracious throughout the entire thing. So Joel, thank you, and we'll be back next week.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.